and welcome to episode 140. Oh my gosh, jazz hands. Of Craft, Cook, Read, Repeat, a conversation about crafting food and books. I'm Monica.
And I'm Courtney.
Today is Thursday, May 9th, 2024. A big thank you to all of our listeners, both old and new. We hope this podcast will continue to be something you put on repeat. How's it going, Courtney?
On my drive over here, and when I crested the top of the hill behind you and could see 25 miles out to sea, crystal clear, very warm, beautiful. And that is when I'm
reminded.
No, I'm reminded this is why houses sell really well in San Francisco when we have days like this.
Yes. Yes. You're surviving the heat.
Well, I'm here in a short sleeve sweater.
Yes.
Which might have to be jettisoned for just the t-shirt.
Yeah.
It is
toasty.
Promising to push into my least favorite range of temperature, which is above 80.
Yeah. We shall see.
What does that do? Can we jump right into On the Needles?
Sure. And after that, we'll have On the Easel, On the Table, and On the Nightstand. But yes, my temperature scarf, I finally hit the highest, warmest color of yarn.
I was thinking of it that was the only thing that was going to bring me pleasure about this heat wave, I'm calling it, was that
it is for San Francisco. I mean, it's hot inland. It's the hottest days we've had in the Bay Area since October.
Yes.
Which is one of our hottest months traditionally, I believe. Yes, no, yesterday jumped into the warmest yarn color, which is very exciting. That means we got above 74, or I guess we hit 74 and went above it. Yeah, it's kind of funny when I get to days like this, and yesterday I think, I don't know, my temperature thing was weird. It said 77 for a while, then it went back down to 74. Either way, it's still in the warmest yarn. But then today is supposed to get to 81. And I feel like there should be some way to note that. But that we have so few days at this temperature that it is sort of relatively the same as far as my scarf is concerned. problems.
It's exciting.
It is very exciting. I am pleased to have these days and to break out a new yarn color. That is the Whether or Not scarf. The yarn from Holstgarn Coast, which is a nice fingering weight. And it's all that I almost forgot to take. What month are we in? May. I almost forgot to take my April photo. So that one should be going up on the Instagram soon, although probably before you actually are able to hear this. So it should be up there. Yeah, we're definitely getting more warmer colors. Very fun. Right after we had a bunch of really cold days. So that is life in the Bay Area. I guess it's probably spring anywhere. Very random. Other things going on the needles. I had a lovely time at my Northern California knitters retreat. We had nice weather. It was a little windy and cool to start, which was fine because then it gave us more opportunities to wear our sweaters, our hand-knit sweaters, because, you know, knitters like to wear their sweaters and show them off to other people who will appreciate the artistry. So that was super fun. It was just a nice, relaxing weekend. I handed in 8 completed knit and knockers out of Cascade Ultra Pima for our charity donation that we like to make. They do a raffle for those of us that knit the knockers. And so I won a skein of Malabrigo, which is lovely and very exciting. Not why I do it, but, you know, nice bonus. While I was there, I also finished my Sun Salutation cardigan by Celia McAdams, which was the sweater pattern for the retreat. And what did I have to do? So I arrived, finished the first sleeve, the first late afternoon I was there. It was so nice leaving early. I know we talked about that the last time. The traffic, it only took me like an hour and 45 maybe get there. Whereas the past few years, it's been like 2.5 because I would hit traffic and it would just be very sad and annoying. But no, but this was great. So I got there. I had time in the afternoon to knit. And then I finished the cuff at night. And then I spent the whole next day knitting the second sleeve and finished it. So I got to ring the bell. We have a bell that you get to ring if you finish a project while you're there. Very fun. I don't know that I've ever rung the bell before.
I need to install a bell for when I finish a painting or
there
something.
There you go. Yeah, so that was exciting. And then I put it away and I have not woven in the ends yet or blocked it. And it really needs to be blocked. So still a little work needed to to finish it off completely. But the colorway, which is the Neighborhood Fiber Company Studio DK in the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which is the Michelle Obama colorway, is very nice. It's burgundy, purplish, tonal, I guess we would call it. I think it's going to be nice and cozy once we need, you know, once summer gets here and we need our nice cozy cardigans for wearing. So I'm excited about that one as well. I also finished my Gnome News is Good News by Sarah Shiro, which is the latest mystery gnome along. The yarn I used for that was Woolens and Nosh Targi Sock in the colorway Tulip, which was a special skein slash colorway that she did for this knit along. So part of the skein was a self-striping, and then it went into a contrast color, and then the final bit was some white for the nose and the beard. The contrast color is a light pink, and the stripes were, I think, green and yellow and a bright pink, all very bright, cheery, spring, tulip-like colors. So that was really fun knit. She made it so that the point of it was the self-striping. I mean, you could do it in a variegated as well, I think, but it was fun, springy. I enjoyed it. Very quick. I think there were only 5 clues, but she is traveling now. So if you want, now that if you look at it and you're like, ooh, I do actually want to knit that, you still have time. I think you have until June 18th to enter for fabulous prizes. So maybe check that gnome out if you are interested or have been thinking about gnoming and have not yet done it. Or, you know, you've just been waiting around.
Is this the first time we've turned gnome into a verb?
Can't be gnoming? Right. I'm sure we have. I'm sure we have before. It was quite simple. And I have some plans for maybe some other gnomes, other versions of this gnome later. So stay tuned for that. What else? I've been doing quite a good bit of knitting lately. I've been working away on the Sockhead Slouch Hat by Kelly McClure in the Super Glow Super Sock in the colorway Hula Hula, which is kind of a neon pinky orangey speckled business. That was my after dinner knitting at the retreat. So I finished the 3.5 inches of ribbing, and then I've been working on the, I think it's 9.5 inches of stockinette. I haven't measured it lately to see how far along I am, but I had a track meet last weekend, so I got some done then, and then I have another one this weekend, and hopefully I'll have one the following weekend, so that should be done pretty quickly. It's also, I've done some TV knitting with that. It's just very nice and relaxing and so bright, which is a really fun color. And then I also, at the retreat, I also started on my Winterview scarf by Cecilia Campo Chiaro. The yarn I'm using for that is a verb for keeping warm nibble in the colorway Marine Layer. The colorway is their Bay Area Yarn Crawl colorway, so I got that during the yarn crawl. And then they're having a knit along for the colorway, so you can knit anything, any yarn base, but in that colorway, which is kind of a fun way of doing it. So I was kind of glad of an excuse to, you know, use up something quickly. And the nibble is a new yarn for them, so it's fun to test that out as well. It's a fingering weight, but kind of chunky or nubbly. It's not super smooth. And I think it's all local sheep. So it's fun to try out a new yarn and see how that works. The scarf was designed to use and to show off the colorway. In our packet, I think I mentioned we also get a skein of a mini skein. I think it's like 5 grams of a contrast colorway. It's just a pretty simple triangular scarf shawl. I'm only using the one skein of the nibble, so it's going to be more of a shawlette or even like a kerchief. You just knit to pattern until you have a certain amount of yarn left. I should probably weigh what I have left at some point, see where I am. And then you do a border with the contrast color. But I love how the colorway is turning out. It's kind of an oatmeal with reds and blues. So sort of a fog at sunset idea, I think. It's really beautiful. I love the way it's turning out. It's just very evenly distributed. There's no flashing or pooling or any weirdness like that, which can be very cool, but it's also really nice when it just is
working.
Speckles of color all over. Yeah, just really good. It's nice and squishy. The only problem is, and it's a very simple pattern, but it's really hard to count 3-1, 3-1, 3-1 for some reason. And I'll get to the end of a row and my numbers do not end up where they are supposed to be, or my stitches do not.
This is very relatable.
Stitches do not end up where they're supposed to be. And it's like, oh, okay, so then I have to go back and untink. It's fine. It's delightful to knit with. So I will continue working on that, which is fun. And then I finally started my new sweater. It's actually a t-shirt because, you know, summer. I am knitting a Ranunculus by Midori Hirose. This is a project that has over 23,000 projects on Ravelry. It is a huge sweater. It is one of those things that either you have knit it and you've knit multiple, it seems to be, or you have not knit it and you sort of feel great pride in that and you're just not going to knit it. So I had decided I wanted to try it out because, you know, it is very popular and there must be a reason, right? And I had seen a couple of people who knit it as a short sleeve summer top. So I thought, oh, that would be great. And I thought, well, but I'll do it in linen cotton. And I had gotten some yarn during the yarn crawl from Knit House on Main, which just announced they have to close because they lost their lease and it's very sad. Well, but so luckily I have this yarn, which is from Sarado Watakami. They're Rilili in Kujaku, which is a teal. So it's really beautiful. I'm very excited about it. Part of the thing is, of the Ranunculus is that you can knit it in lace weight or you can knit it in worsted. And it looks great either way, which is kind of magical.
Tell me more.
There are reasons for this. And when you come in with different yarn at a different gauge, you might run into some problems and have to do a lot of note-taking and math and changing things around.
Never mind.
Yeah. Well, no, but if you knit it, I guess the theory is what I eventually figured it out. I was just like, oh, great. You can knit any yarn, any gauge. It'll all be fine. It was the any gauge part that I was wrong about. So it has a set gauge. And so you can knit it in worsted or in lace weight at the same gauge, and it'll turn out a very different sweater. So you're basically knitting lace weight at worsted weight gauge is what you're doing, which is fine. But it's weird because it starts off with one set of cast on instructions for all the yarn types, which is really strange for knitting. Usually, if you're messing with the gauge on a sweater, you know, you have a different yarn or your fabric is different that you like or whatever, you can do a little bit of math and figure out, okay, if this is my gauge, which number of stitches in this range that they've given me will work at this gauge, right? So if you're supposed to cast on 15, but you have a, you know, whatever, bigger or smaller, cast on a different number.
I'm paying very close attention right now. I want you to know this because I always fall in love with the yarn first and I don't want to just look for a pattern that matches the yarn. I want to make what I want to make with that yarn.
Yeah, that's tricky. I mean, it depends what you're making.
Not so much.
It's easy math. I mean, it's easy math. So you figure out what your gauge is and how many stitches per inch you're getting. And then you see like, okay, so if I cast on this many stitches, this is how big around it will be. But I don't want it to be that big. I want it to be bigger. So I need to cast on a larger size or smaller, depending on how the math works out. It's easy.
It's the M word again.
It's really easy and very straightforward. However, if you've got one set of cast on instructions, it's not so easy. So anyway, luckily, when I realized what was happening, I was sitting next to a bunch of other knitters because I cast this on at the retreat. And the person sitting right next to me is a designer who has books and sweaters, you know, lots of patterns, dozens and dozens of patterns. So I was able to talk through the whole thing, like, what is going on? First of all, after she was done ripping on this pattern, what is this? Why is there only one thing? She's like, this is not how I would write a pattern. We eventually figured out what I needed to do was skip to the part where the numbers made sense. Skip the original cast on because you did sort of a neck band and then you immediately increase. And the increase number sounded like it would work, that it would get over my head. It would, you know, fit the sweater over my head. So I decided to cast that on. And she said, well, then you just go back and you pick up as many stitches as you actually need for your neckline and knit up, as you often do with sweaters. This is not a new concept. I said, oh, that makes sense. So I did that. So I've knit most of the yoke. So it's a yoke, lace yoke pattern, and then you do some raglan shaping, and then
off you go.
Off you go. Very simple. So I've finished the lace part. It looks lovely. I tried it on. It fits over my head. It looks like the shaping is gonna work well. So I've done the raglan. Well, so then I started to do the raglan shaping, and I realized my row gauge is also off, because that's also what happens when you mess with needles and yarn and your gauge. So I'm having to play around with both the raglan shaping and how long I am knitting for. Because she is knitting it at a very large gauge, it takes fewer increases and rows. So there is a little more trying on that is going to happen, and you know, messing with things, basically. But I think it'll be fine. I mean, it's basically just ideally, I would just be able to find a raglan t-shirt in the gauge that I'm doing and steal their numbers. That might be more complicated and annoying. It might just be easier for me to try it on, which is currently my plan, and see, like, okay, I need a few more stitches on the sleeves. I need a little, you know, couple more inches in the length. And then after that, I think it's just whoop, knitting in stockinette, and that should be easy enough. So I think it's going to work out. It's just a little more complicated than I expected. And probably if I'd actually knit the sweater on its own first, as it was intended to be knit, it would have made the whole thing very much easier, because I would have understood what I was getting into. But no, I kind of went like a Courtney project.
Oh, this is...
Let's just change everything.
I can't fault that, because you end up learning a lot.
Yeah.
Including what not to do.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it'll be fine. And what I will probably do is when I get to... I guess I could even do that now. Because I was thinking, I want to make sure... Because I'm also changing the yarn type. And I want to make sure that the stitch pattern is going to look okay in this yarn. And so when I was doing my swatch, I did a little bit of the lace, but there's some kind of Japanese stitches that are sort of like slip stitches that happen. So I might block the whole thing, not the whole thing, just the yoke, before I continue on with miles of stockinette, just to make sure that it does look how I think it's going to look. My swatch, I did a swatch with patterning and I blocked it.
You went the distance.
I did. Very proud of me. I'm a grown-up knitter with this project. Yeah, so it looked like it really filled in, and the blocking definitely changes how it looks. So I think it's going to be good. We shall see. It's been an adventure for sure. But yeah, lots of exciting projects. How about you?
Lots of exciting projects on the easel as well. So guess what I've been doing?
What have you been doing? I actually know. I've actually known for a while. I assume this is what you're going to... The big reveal.
The big unveil. I have been painting a series of ebook covers. And I think it's important to point out that currently they're strictly ebooks. And this comes into play for a couple different reasons. One, I don't e-read. I only read paper, and I haven't read the books that I've painted the covers for. But I'll talk about the process in a second. The other thing that's interesting that Monica pointed out, I think it was you who pointed it out, was that if you're reading these books on a Kindle, they're often, it's black and white, right? Mm. The covers.
I don't know if I pointed that out, but that is true.
I think you did.
Yeah,
and what's important about that is I'm painting them in gouache, in color. And so I found myself checking the contrast constantly throughout the process, like making sure that they were going to look really good in black and white or grayscales throughout the process. So,
yeah, it's like doing color work in knitting. You have to, a lot of times people suggest like taking your yarns and doing a black and white photo and making sure there is still contrast.
Exactly. And even when we were talking about that, what's it called? Color dominance.
Mm-hmm.
Using that trick with your phone camera is really useful, because you can see, once you eliminate the color element of it, you can really see things in an interesting way. So I have been painting this series of book covers. The author is Nancy Robards Thompson, and she is a mystery and romance writer. And I'm doing the Wedding Bell mystery quartet. There's four books. Three of them are published and one is releasing this summer. And so they did a cover refresh for a couple different reasons. Her publisher is Thule Publishing down in San Clemente. It has been really delightful to execute these covers. What I thought I would share with people was a little bit of my process. The publisher provided me with the author's creative brief for each book, and they were super detailed. And I did feel like maybe I should read the books before I paint them. But honestly, I'm very glad that I didn't, because I think I would have gotten, because I'm a huge reader, I think I might have gotten hung up on my impressions of the book. And so I almost, now that I'm done with the process, I think it's better that I just use their cover brief and executed their vision instead of letting my own impressions creep in any which way. And so the books take place in this little town in North Carolina, and they wanted it to feel like it was set in town and have the small town elements come through. And there's a pair of corgis that feature on each of the book covers. They're the same pair of dogs. So I've gotten pretty good at painting a passable corgi, which is saying something, because corgis have really interesting proportions. They have bat-shaped ears, and their leg-to-body proportions are interesting, and some of them have tails, and some of them are docked. And so trying to keep all four covers similar with the dogs was a fun challenge. And then, of course, leaving room for the important information on a book cover, like title, author, the series title, and the author's accolades. She is a New York Times bestselling author, and it's important to note that on a cover. And leaving room for all of that in the composition has been a good challenge for me. And then trying to keep some cohesion from book to book to book to book, in terms of either, obviously, the dogs, but some color carryover. There's a book for each season, and making sure that if there's foliage in it, that it is aligned and sort of geographically appropriate. It's been a fantastic challenge for me, and I have really enjoyed it. So I'm happy to point people to the Thule page, where you can see the three covers that are live right now, and then the next one is coming soon when it publishes.
So exciting.
It's very exciting.
You've been sitting on this for a long time.
Yeah, I think I thought the timeline would be a lot quicker, and I felt like I was holding back because I've been wanting to talk about the process. In a way, I'm glad that I wasn't sharing as we went along, because I've really learned a lot along the way. And, you know, sometimes it's important to sit with your own lessons and figure things out. And in the end, I'm super proud of this. In fact, I'm going to go home today and put it down in my 2024 achievements. I'm really happy with it. And I have heard really good things from the creative team at the publishing house. So that makes me feel good too. So that's my sort of encapsulates the last few months. And now I feel like this weird amount of creative freedom, which I've sort of had all along. But now that I can let go of a palette, like I've been sort of holding on to this, literally and figuratively, holding on to a palette of paint in order to keep that continuity for the book covers. I am sort of done with that, with that palette. I've made all the color notes. So if I need to tweak anything, or if I'm honored enough to be asked to do another cover in the future, I know where we were in terms of the color language. But I'm taking a color mastery class. Ooh. It's an online class with Lena Rivo, who is a big YouTube paint instructor. And I've taken something else with her before. She's great with plein air painting, which is, you know, I mentioned that I had missed plein air April or plein April. And so I thought it would be good to have this color refresh. So I'm taking that, and I'm excited to show some of the work. We're doing some drawing basics and everything right now, and that's fine. I actually am pretty comfortable with all of the drawing. I love to draw. I draw all the time, sketch all the time. So that part feels really comfortable to me, but I'm excited to dive into the color mixing. And it's these three new paints that I almost never use, these colors. And then I'm letting go of like four of my favorite colors that are my go-tos for mixing greens and things like that. And that feels really uncomfortable. And feeling uncomfortable right now feels great because I've been super focused on the book covers and making sure that they are aligned, I guess, is a good word. And then my other little pet project that I'm diving into is something that I did many years ago when in an undergrad studio class, which was like a museum study where you pick a master and you kind of, I think I only did like a drawing of a master study. I am going to have more fun with it this time around. I sort of remember the gist of it. And a master study, in a rough sense, is to copy a master. Sometimes you can do it in a different medium. Sometimes you could just pay attention to the technique and execute. So if you're looking at a Van Gogh landscape, you could do a California landscape in Van Gogh style, kind of like what Diebenkorn did with Cézanne, like he was influenced by Cézanne. So by looking at paintings that I love, and then playing with either that style or technique, or maybe making, I don't think I'll make a copy. That's something that doesn't interest me so much, but like there's a painting called La Berceuse by Van Gogh, which is a really unflattering portrait of this woman in his village. I love it. I have loved it for 30 years. So I'm really interested to find a subject that I can sort of not worry about, make it beautiful. Like I kind of want to make some ugly art for a little while, and I am excited to do that.
Oh, sounds delightful.
I have been very off of, I haven't really been sharing a lot of art, and I feel like I might as well keep making weird things, and if I post it, I post it. If not, it's not like I have been, I haven't been posting anything anyway.
Yeah, you've been doing all this stuff where it has to be approved by someone else.
Right.
So to just do whatever the heck you want and not care about how it looks, really.
Right.
I mean, as long as you are excited about the process, that's just got to be such a nice feeling.
And I think that's why I'm leaning into the impressionism a little bit, is because I feel like everything was getting very tight and refined, you know, like crisp, an illustration. I've been doing a lot of illustration work, and it's time to dust off and do some paint yoga.
Excellent. Can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Or not, whatever you decide to share.
Thank you.
On the table. So I have been diving into the hot honey. I'm just on a hot honey kick, because why not? So the first thing I made was hot honey shrimp. Different hot honey shrimp from the one that Courtney made. So the night I came back from the retreat, I had planned to do baked potatoes because that just seemed super easy. That was what we were going to do for dinner. And I don't know, I'd have them with the vegetables and cheese and, you know, all the baked potato things. But we had baked potatoes for our final lunch at the retreat. And so I came home and said, nope, not having baked potatoes twice. So I had to quick scramble. I didn't really have anything. I had a bunch of produce, but I didn't really have a lot of other items. I did have some frozen shrimp. So I thought, oh, hot honey shrimp. Let me see what Courtney's recipe is, which she sent me. But I had forgotten that there was a marinade time, and I think I texted her at like 6:30 at night, so there wasn't really time for marinating. So instead, I went on the internet and found another hot honey shrimp where you grill it and you just brush it with the sauce. And so it was a pretty simple sauce: garlic, olive oil, the hot honey, obviously, some lemon juice, dried oregano, salt and pepper. And then you squeeze some more hot honey on after. And so this was a grilling recipe, and I ended up, I broiled it, I think, because that was your suggestion, and that worked quite well. And so I just brushed it, you know, the sauce on the top. It was really nice. And then I did a little squeeze of the honey after. I think we had rice and vegetables and probably mushrooms for the husband, and just very simple, very fast, and quite tasty. And then, you know, the algorithm said, oh, you're interested in hot honey. So it pushed me a hot honey peach margarita.
What?
I know. I was making enchiladas last night and I thought, oh, it's the perfect time to try it out.
Excellent pairing.
Right? It was really good. You are supposed to muddle peach halves, just like, or I guess in the video, this was on the Instagram. So
it's okay. I get served Instagram food recipes almost exclusively.
Yeah. So the Trader Joe's peach halves, I just used peach halves or peach slices. So I was kind of guessing at how much peach I would need. Supposed to muddle them. You add lime juice.
Like canned peaches or fresh?
No, canned.
Oh my gosh.
Like the Trader Joe's jar of the peach halves? Yes. I mean, I guess obviously you could use fresh once it gets to fresh peach time.
Right. It's not peach season though.
Yeah. And you know, if it's the depths of winter and you want a nice cheery drink, here you go. So the peach halves, lime juice, hot honey, just a nice squeeze of it. She used a lot more than I did, I will say. I could definitely have had, I could have added some more. And then tequila and Cointreau.
Excellent.
She put it in a shaker and then strained it all. I just put it in my little mini blender and blended it. Probably the muddling it and straining it would have been a little better. It was a little bit thick, but it had a nice little bit of zippy flavor. It was really fun and delicious. That was highly amusing.
I very much approve of a little festive, whatever night you ate this, drink this.
Yeah, it wasn't even Cinco de Mayo. I was really pleased with that. And then for non-hot honey food, I made sausage meatballs with halloumi and tomatoes. This is Jenny Rosenstark via Cup of Joe, not Dinner Love Story. Although I think she put a link to it on her blog as well. Again, super simple. Actually, is this even her recipe? This might be someone else. I should check on that. Anyway, I got to it from Jenny. So a sheet pan supper, cherry tomatoes, chopped up halloumi, sausage meat, just pulled off into little bits, oil, bake it. I'm trying to think what else was there. And I really think there was not, you know, salt and pepper. And then at the end, throw some spinach on there and mush it around so it gets a little bit wilted. I did two separate sheet pans. So each one had a pint of cherry tomatoes. One had all the sausage. One had all the halloumi. They each got a bunch of spinach as well. So, you know, for the two different family
members.
Yeah. Or I guess, everybody's home now. There were four of us eating dinner. It's very exciting. Super easy. Takes, you know, seconds to prepare. And then I think 25 minutes in the oven. So just delightful.
Does the halloumi get crispy on a sheet pan or just warm?
Mostly just warm. Maybe the bottom was a little bit crispy. Mm. The only thing was you need to be careful with the salt, which I didn't, because it says to salt the tomatoes, which makes sense. But then you've got the halloumi and the sausage, both very salty. So my people were happy because they do like salt. But I thought it was a little just on the edge of being too much. I made some quinoa to go with that just to have something else, and because there were juices to soak up. I really liked it. It was definitely something that I want to repeat in the future, and because a lot of that is things that you would just have, like tomatoes and spinach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's generally something that is around our house. So recommend that one as well. How about you?
Well, we are not a party of four yet, but it's fast approaching, and I am terrified because most of the time I just cook for two because there's generally somebody traveling or somebody off climbing or whatever. I don't know how I'm going to amp up to having all four people eating. In fact, I would like to implement other people cook nights, which might be the only way I survive this summer. But it will be joyful, that's for sure. So in that vein, I have been cooking as little as humanly possible. No, I'm just kidding. We've just been making, I would say, the tried and true easy batch cooking breaded chicken, or I did like a chicken roulade thing that was something I made up with like a cream cheese filling with shallots and herbs. Super simple. Yeah, haven't been doing anything crazy, but in the sort of baked category, I ran into some great friends at a school auction. Hi, Nolans. Hi, Sheila. We were talking lots about the podcast, so I know they're listening. Sheila is a baker, and she makes these amazing cakes, mostly for her family because she has a day job. But we got to talking about bakeries around San Francisco, and they do bakery walks where they'll get up on a Saturday really early, and they live over like in the Excelsior, and they'll walk to the Castro for Le Marais or Thoroughbred or one a million. That she will walk for a good croissant. I love this. So where I'm going with that is, should Monica depart and leave us to record like a interview episode again, Sheila is going to be my food person, because we had so much fun talking about cakes at this school auction that it made the whole thing worthwhile. Okay, so after talking to Sheila about that, then I was sort of craving an almond croissant. There are a million almond croissant options in San Francisco, but we were busy because we were like headed into prom season. And so Adam brought home, he went to Thoroughbred one morning after having spoken with her about this, and brought me a really delicious almond croissant. It doesn't have quite as much almond as Noe Valley Bakery puts in their almond croissants, but it was still great. So it got me thinking about croissants.
How does it compare to Arisco?
Nobody compares to Arisco, or however you pronounce
it. No, probably.
No one. In my opinion, Arisco is hands down the best croissant of any category in the city.
Just checking.
Yeah. So I had croissants on the brain. It was sort of quenched by this one from Thoroughbred, but I was still thinking about croissants. And then we hosted prom for my younger son and all of his group of friends. And the parents were really generous, and they brought snacks and they brought pastries for the next morning. All of my obsessing about croissants was realized in full, because there were, I don't know how many baked goods in my house. It felt like 40 croissants from different bakeries and different kinds, and like a savory croissant. And my husband bought a box of croissants from Costco, which seemed sacrilege in comparison to, so obviously we ate all the great croissants fresh, you know, as you do. And then I was pretty, I had croissant fatigue, and I still had, we still had this box of croissants that were, I don't know, I wasn't very excited about the Costco ones. And I made the chicken meatballs from Smitten Kitchen, and it called for a couple loaves of white bread to be pulled apart. And I thought, well, I'll throw in a couple croissants. Oh my word. And then I thought, ooh, garlic bread would be fun. And so I made garlic toast with the Costco croissants. Again, sacrilege probably, but more like, is this sacrilege to French culture or genius? Like, it was a real hard, it was really good. So if you find yourself with a plethora of croissants, I recommend meatballs, garlic bread. Yeah. That's the croissant drama from our house.
It's very exciting. That is some drama.
I'm just here for content.
Well, I was thinking, I feel like I have some brunch books or brunch sections in books that do things with croissants.
Yeah.
Like a French toast kind of thing.
French toast interests
me. It wouldn't need to be an amazing croissant.
Right. I would not.
You wouldn't want to use an amazing croissant,
right,
I don't think.
Right, right. I have seen La Boulange or La Boulangerie, however you say it. They do a bread pudding with their leftover croissants.
Yeah.
I have bread pudding trauma from my childhood.
Okay.
So that is a no-go for me.
All right.
But that's what made the meatball thing so awesome.
Or you, I like you could put Nutella in there and just griddle
waffle
it up.
It.
Yep. Yep, can exactly.
Like I said to Matthew last night, we could put these on the waffle iron.
Yeah, I think so.
He was a huge fan of the garlic toast croissants.
Yeah, I love taking it in a savory direction, though. That is unexpected and delightful.
Well
done.
Thank you. Now I'm okay to not see a croissant for a long, long time.
Sure. I will keep that in mind.
Unless you want to go to Arsico.
Yeah, always. On the nightstand, I have had a really nice couple of weeks of reading kind of random stuff. First, X by Sue Grafton, the penultimate Kinsey Millhone. I can't believe it.
On penultimate?
I know. I had to work. It was like, I get to work it in. I was very excited.
I love that you worked it in. I love that you know the correct usage of it. I wish other people did. It sounds like the best, but it's not.
It's not.
It's not the last. It's the second to last.
Yep.
It's so weird.
It's very strange. It's a very weird word to have in our language, but we do. So let's use it. So I listened to this, and I can't remember if I talked about this on the podcast or if I just mentioned it to Courtney, but I was really worried about this book because the description of it, which I had read before I started it, was it's one of her most frightening books yet. We get in the mind of a serial killer. And that is a genre that I do not like. I don't care what they're thinking. I want them tracked down by the detective and sent to jail. I don't need to know why they're doing what they're doing. I don't care. So I was really worried that she was going to go back to having all these alternate chapters, as our dear friend Sue had been doing, and we'd have all these, you know, the mind of the serial killer. So I was, you know, I wanted to finish the series. I'm so close to the end now. So I wanted to finish it happily. No serial killer chapters. Yes. And I kept thinking, oh, like we're pretty far in now. And I think when I got to chapter 10 or something, I was like, she can't be doing it. I'm home free. So it was great. It was just classic. It was back to the original days of Kinsey Millhone. It's all her. There's like three different little mysteries going on that she's juggling. One of them, she doesn't even realize what's going on. It was just fantastic all around. There's art theft. We don't know that he's a serial killer until later on. We know he's creepy and definitely not a nice guy, but so there's all the investigation. It does tie back into one of the other books. There's a neighbor battle around the drought that California is starting to experience because I think we're in 1989 now. So it was just fantastic. There were points where I was saying, Kinsey, did you not catch that clue? That was just smacking you in the face. I caught that clue. I caught all these clues. It was not the most complicated of mysteries, but it's fine because it was great. I was very excited. And now I kind of feel like I don't want to read the last one because then I'll be done. But I do also want to be done. So we will see. I do have it checked out and I'm interested to see how it ends since she passed away before she could finish the series. And I don't know at what point she decided that there was not, and her family's also said there will not be a book Z. So this is definitely the final one. And I don't know how she's going to end it. I will let you know. Then I also read Expiration Dates by Rebecca Searle. This is her recent one. I think it just came out this spring. She's written a couple other books that I've read. One Italian Summer, I think, came out last year. They are not romances. Maybe love stories is a better way to describe them. There's definitely romance happening, but there's also some gut-punchy emotional things going on. The Italian one, the main character was recovering from the death of her mother by visiting this Italian town that they were supposed to go to together. And there's always also a little bit of magic going on in an otherwise very non-magical real-life kind of world. In the Italian one, the girl runs into her mother's, not even ghost, it's her mother when she's the same age that the main character is. So there's that. So this one, we have Daphne, who is, I think she's 33 or so. She lives in LA, born and raised there. Whenever she meets a new guy, a letter or a postcard or some sort of piece of paper appears that has his name and how long they will be going out for. So she always knows how long any relationship is going to last until she's set up to go on a blind date by one of her best friends, and the paper arrives and there's no date. What does it mean? She figures that means this is the guy. And the story goes on from there. There is some twists and turns there and some very emotional stuff. So just be prepared. This is not a straightforward romance, but I really liked it. I blasted through it. It's just very sweet. It's really fun to see all of the relationships that she's been in and how they all, you know, how they helped her become the person that she is. It's also kind of a love letter to LA. I think this is part of what she does. The first book I read of hers was in New York. This next one was in Cinque Terre. So lots of food and restaurants and cool cultural attractions in whatever city the story is happening in. So that is very enjoyable, something that I like reading about as well. They do eventually have a nice, happy, hopeful ending. So even though they are not traditional romances. Next, The Extinction of Irena Ray by Jennifer Croft, which for me at least was just a very meta roller coaster that I enjoyed very much. The story itself is pretty straightforward. Irena Ray is a Polish author, world famous, expected to win the Nobel Prize for Literature any day now. And it's been a while since her last book came out. So when her translators get a message to come to her house on the edge of a Polish forest to do a translation summit, they are very excited. They all arrive. Irena likes to have all her translators come before her book is actually published, and they read it together and write it together. And that's what everyone expects to happen this time. But things are a little off. Irena is kind of strange. Her husband isn't there and she doesn't say why. She takes them on a march into the forest and starts talking about mushrooms and evolution. And then the second day they wake up and she is not there. And they have all received an email with an attachment of her next, the manuscript of her next book. And things just keep getting weirder and weirder. So it's a little bit gothic, because you do have the house and the people and the strange things happening. And then the story that we are reading is allegedly written by the Spanish translator in but she wrote it in Polish. And it's, you know, based on the actual events. And then what we are reading is the English translation from the English translator, who has a note at the beginning that this was a very hard book for her to translate because she is one of the main characters and she is not treated well. So there are a lot of little footnotes where she's like, yeah, no, this is not what happened. This is not what I was thinking. And she also mentions that she is not going to comment on the truthfulness of any of the events in the book. But she would like to point out that she now lives in Mongolia with her partner, who is a lawyer, and that Mongolia does not have an extradition treaty with Poland or the United States. So a little bit of foreshadowing and adding to the creepiness factor. The other thing, and the reason I originally picked it up, is that Jennifer Croft, the actual author of the actual book, is the Booker Prize award-winning translator of a Polish author who has actually won the Nobel Prize. So there are just lots of layers here about translation and, you know, what it means to be a translator and what it means to be an artist and how we look at people. It was really interesting. It was a little bit hard to tell if the writing style was just Jennifer Croft's writing style or if she was trying to sound a little bit like a book in translation. It was really weird in a lot of places, but also a really interesting story. So overall, I would say that one was a thumbs up as well, because I do like the kind of weird stuff. And then The Other Valley by Scott Alexander Howard. It is the story of a small town that is next to a lake in a valley. And if you go up and over the mountain pass to the east, you will find the same exact town, but 20 years in the future. And if you go up and over the mountain pass to the west, you will find the same town 20 years in the past. And that is true of all the towns. There's just a string of little towns and that are all 20 years apart. So you are not allowed to go visit the other towns because that could mess up.
It's important to have rules.
The time continuum, you know. However, there are exceptions. There is a council that you can apply to visit the other towns to observe. And they usually grant that for reasons of grief. So if a child dies unexpectedly, you can wait 20 years and then go see them again. You can't talk to them, but you can see them. Or if you're a grandparent and you're not going to live to see your grandchild, you can wait and, you know, go the other direction and see someone. And so our story starts with Odile, who is 16. She accidentally sees a visitation that she should not have seen. And it kind of starts a whole chain of events in motion that, I don't know, would it have happened? Would it not have happened? Like, how does that change things? The author I think he was trying to accomplish something and didn't fully think through his world building. So the story itself was really interesting, but there were the details were a little bit lacking in parts of it, and that kind of annoyed me. But I really liked the story, and I was interested to see where it was going to go. A lot about love and what you would do for love and family and versus following the rules and what makes a life important. And so it had a lot of really interesting and good parts as well. So I would check that one out also. And then Northwoods by Daniel Mason, which I don't know. Have you heard of this one? Mm-hmm. Have you read it yet?
I just started it the other night.
Okay. I think you'll like it. We shall
it
see.
Reminds me of the one about the girl, the Jamestown, like so far.
Oh, the opening chapter does. Yeah. Just you wait. So we read this for book club and everybody in the book club loved it or liked it very much. We did have questions about it. But anyway, it is the story of a piece of land and a house and the people who live there in northern Massachusetts, starting with kind of Puritan times and going through, well, the future, quite frankly. So there's just different little stories about different people that are on this property and the house and how they all interact with the land. He wrote this book during COVID, and so apparently he has said that this was his chance to just try out different writing styles. So every story is a little bit different in terms of theme and how it's written, which is really interesting and keeps you on your toes. We never came to a real good what exactly the point of it all was, but we all very much enjoyed reading it, and it was a really great and very lively discussion. And he's one of those people. He went to Harvard valedictorian, is now a psychiatry professor at Stanford, and this is not his first book. He's written a bunch and been shortlisted for Pulitzer. So
the language is, I'm only a couple chapters in, and the language is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I'm excited to, I kind of tuned out what you were saying for a second there because I am actively reading it.
Yeah,
so.
It's probably good.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of book clubs are reading this. Someone else in our book club had already read it for a book club, and someone else was reading it. She had it a second book club the next night. So she was very excited because she felt ready for the discussion. I'm great.
I love it.
Yeah, it's really fun. And then finally, James by Percival Everett. This is a retelling of Huckleberry Finn from the point of view of Jim, who is the enslaved man that was traveling with Huck. And I don't know that I've ever read that book. So this was...
What?
I know. I think I've read Tom Sawyer. But I don't remember reading. I mean, yeah, it's one of those.
Wow.
Yeah, so apparently I need to read it.
Not
there
really.
Is. Well, there. But I think there is one of my reading challenges. I think there's either reread something you read in school or something that you didn't read in school. Or so that might be anyway, because it is problematic, obviously. So this one, I hadn't realized how much time they spend apart because James is off on his own for a long while. He is very much, I think in the book, he is portrayed as sort of uneducated, and in this, he is not. All of the enslaved people are not necessarily educated, but they speak, I want to say, proper English, grammatically correct, not what people... And they do this as a way of protecting themselves from their owners. He is very kind to Huck. He is protective of his family and all the people that he meets on his travels. It's funny and sad at the same time. I haven't read any of Percival Everett's books before. One of them has been on my list for a while, Telephone. And I also found out he wrote the book that the movie American Fiction was based on, which is supposed to be a fantastic movie. So I am very much looking forward to reading a lot more of his works. He's a professor at USC and has a huge back catalog. Oh my gosh, so many. I am very upset with myself that I have not read any of his works before, because it does feel like he is out there writing away. And I guess actually that's kind of the point of American Fiction. So, but yeah, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
I'm kind of shocked at his back catalog too.
Right?
I didn't know it was that deep.
Yeah.
I read Erasure in grad school, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the American Fiction one.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Good list.
It's been good. Yeah. I'm working through my overly stuffed library arrivals.
Mine is kind of, this is a lightweight list.
That feels reasonable for where you are.
Yes. After losing my father-in-law, I was like, I couldn't do some of the heavier novels that I had queued up. And so I have like 3.5 not heavy novels for you. First up, The Princess of Las Vegas by Chris Bahajalan. I adore Chris Bahajalan. I have read everything that he's published.
Is this his latest one?
I am pretty sure it's his latest. It is based on a tribute show to Princess Diana. The time period is pretty much present day, I think, except like a few years ago when crypto was sort of peaking and really gaining a lot of momentum. So our main character is the Princess Diana tribute actress, I guess, performer. She lives in Las Vegas, and her sister lives in Vermont, and they are twins, and they bear an absolute striking resemblance to Princess Diana. Both of them, even though one of them, you know, is like a social worker in Vermont. Here's what happened. This is a DNF for me. I did not finish. I read half of it. I was starting to feel really not comfortable with how Princess Diana was sort of objectified in a weird way, even though I know this author and I trust him with this type of character. But I realized that, like, while I'm not a monarchist or anything, it felt weird to me. And not in the way that, or maybe similarly in the way that I don't like those episodes of The Crown either. It sort of makes me uncomfortable to pry into those lifestyles because their kids are still living. I don't know. It feels a little off limits to me. Whatever, Courtney. Like, that's my own little weird pet peeve. But the real tipping point was there was a lot of talk about cryptocurrency, and I don't understand it. And there wasn't enough to help me get on board with what cryptocurrency was. Then I didn't care about that, and it became a really big part of the book. And I was like, what am I doing? And so I feel like if I don't like a book, I often don't talk about it because I know how much effort it takes to write a novel. And then there's sometimes when maybe the writing is great. The story is interesting. The content is twice over not for me. And so I share that I'm not going to finish this one, but it might be something that is really interesting to someone else. So that's why I'm putting it out there. Next, on recommendation from Monica, I read The Wedding Party by Jasmine Guillory.
Oh, okay. I hope you liked it.
Oh my gosh. This was super fun for a million reasons.
Yay!
Not to mention that it was pretty spicy, although not as spicy as my kilt book, by the way.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Definitely got to read the kilt book now.
Now I'm blushing. Stop.
I didn't bring it up.
So there's so much to love about this book. It takes place in Oakland, San Francisco. There's a lot of back and forth. It's not so much like, oh, and then we were at Coit Tower, and then we were at the... Like, it's not like that. It's more just like the geography of being these two big cities being joined by a bridge and how that adds to the dynamic of a relationship. And then there's kind of our politics imbued in it because one of the characters works at the mayor's office. Monica talked about this a long time ago, I think, because it's been out for a while. We have three best friends. And I'm forgetting everybody's name. The one best friend is getting married. And then her two friends, a male and a female, they don't get along. Something happened when they first met and there's tension and they like never get together. But because their friend is getting married, they have to help coordinate this wedding party. Come to find out, it was a misunderstanding and super adorable chemistry ensues. I think my chief, it's not even a criticism, but the one really funny thing that I noticed about this book is that whenever they see each other, any combination of them, they order a pizza. And it felt like there was 48 pizzas consumed in the course of this book. I really feel like the Bay Area has a lot more to offer than just pizza, is my only critique.
That's so funny because there's usually a ton of food in her books, and they go to a lot of different restaurants, and I don't remember pizza being that overwhelming, but maybe she just was making that her pizza book.
This is definitely her pizza book. But somebody once did like not a TED talk, but something like that about how to talk to your kids about sex and using pizza as a metaphor. Oh,
okay. I was like, where is this going?
Well, because the book is kind of spicy.
A little bit,
friend.
Yeah.
And the, you know, like everybody likes pizza, but you don't just order the same kind of pizza every time. You talk about it. Do you want half pepperoni? Do you like using that as a euphemism or a metaphor for how to talk to your partner about, you know, what you're looking for. And I just thought that was in my head half the time. So
she does generally have her characters do a lot of consent talk as well. So they could fully lean into the pizza. Maybe she saw the TED talk and
maybe
went for it.
There's like a roasted garlic pizza that's pretty common. The characters were great and the geography was great. And I really, really liked this book, and it was super fast read for me. So that felt good. It was very uplifting. And Jasmine Guillory is a woman of color. And I just felt like all of her characters had, I appreciate the Black joy. Loved it.
Excellent.
And then I read The Antique Hunter's Guide to Murder by C.L. Hunter. This is a little bit of a stretch because I wasn't trying to fulfill a Tacoma Public Library extreme reader thing, but CL are my first two initials, and so I'm calling it because I have been looking for a CLS author and failing.
Is it author or character?
Author.
It's author?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I thought it was character, which I haven't had any luck finding either.
But I browsed two libraries to look for a character whose last name started with S and first name started with C. And apparently, so I guess I have to write a piece of fiction.
C.S. Lewis?
That's C.S.L.
All right. You need C.L.S.?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm going with C.L. Hunter and claiming my first two.
Sure.
Anyway, this is a story about Freya Lockwood, who is... Book opens and she's divorcing and she's an empty nest, and she gets news from her aunt Carol that her longtime uncle figure, who was once a huge mentor, has passed away. And she goes back to her place of origin. This takes place somewhere in England. Arthur has been murdered, but he left them all these clues.
Excellent.
And they embark on unraveling all of these clues that Arthur left for them, the aunt and Freya. And it's kind of hard to unravel. And it also takes us back 25 years when Freya thought she was going to follow in his footsteps and become like an antique buyer or like a museum acquisitionist.
Sure.
And something happened. There was some drama in Cairo, and her boyfriend was murdered, and she never forgave her uncle for it because she thought he was involved somehow. But come to find out, there was more to the drama. It is kind of a romp. It takes place at like some old big family lodge somewhere, and we get it all sorted out. And they kept referring to this Martin Brothers bird, and I read this like really quickly in two nights or whatever, and I didn't have a device upstairs with me when I was reading it. And so finally, when I finished and researched, is there really such thing as a Martin Brothers bird? And there are those, I'm sure there's some at like the V&A museum, but they're like a really ugly big mouth ceramic bird figure. They're, I guess people would find them charming.
I gotta look this up.
Yeah, you do. That was sort of the crux of the book, was these forged Martin Brothers birds. I guess they're worth a lot of money and they're really collectible.
Ooh. Sorry, yeah. They are weird.
Oh, maybe I'll do a sketch of one for the podcast cover.
Oh, they kind of, they're almost like a Disney character. Or
yeah,
like
they look like a caricature of a bird.
Yeah.
Not my fave. There was one of the birds that I liked. It was a kingfisher, but otherwise you can have them. It was a fun mystery. It didn't feel particularly meaty, but it did feel like we were setting Freya up for a serial. And I actually haven't even checked to see if C.L. Hunter has written other books after this one. So that'll be interesting to look at. And then after a very long pause, people, I have gone back to Louise Penny.
Ooh, the new one comes out in October.
Yeah, well, I've got a ways to go because I just finished book 6. So I'm way behind for a couple reasons. I really felt like the Anne Cleves Shetland, those were my people because they were definitely watching birds.
Yeah.
And if Louise had more birds, you know, hint, hint. I'm just kidding. I watched the Amazon Louise Penny, and that kind of, I had to have some distance from it because I felt like while they were well done, I liked the characters. They were amalgamating the mysteries into, like, they were messing up the order, and I...
And squishing them together.
Yeah, and I couldn't figure out, like, what was going on, because I was strong, I was squarely on book 5 then. And so then when I turned back to Bury Your Dead, it felt like coming home a little bit, because Louise's, her trajectory for how each book moves is, that's my preferred alignment. You know, I like getting that interior of Inspector Gamache and his, I mean, he was really struggling in book 6. This is the one where he has, I'm nervous to give a little bit away, but just where I'm at in the series. So he has had to arrest somebody from Three Pines, like somebody who was a friend. All of the evidence pointed that way, but he doesn't feel like it was correct. And so a lot of book 6 is him doubting himself. And I feel like that was a really human and authentic approach to this character. And there's another mystery going on, of course. There's like an archaeological mystery with Champlain, the explorer who founded the European landing in North America. Is that correct? Like that part of Canada? And then we named a lake after him. The other insightful thing about this book was a little bit more of that French and British or English tension that happens in the Quebec-Montreal region that, I mean, I grew up in New England, but I was unaware of it. I don't know if you felt it when you were, because you went to college in Vermont, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that area is still, they have the French language. I mean, Canada still has French as one of their languages. So I think that tension is always more prevalent.
It was just an interesting perspective on it. And I appreciate that. And I am on to book 7. I mean, I really, well, they're like 13 hours long. They're not super long. And now that
I'm
painting more, they're just great listening material.
Yeah.
So hopefully that wasn't too much of a spoiler for anybody. And
I mean, it's been out for years, so I think it's
I did get scolded by Auntie Rita once for talking too much about Louise Penny, and
I think you did an excellent job.
Well, thank you. It was some good reading. I'm ready for a little bit meatier, but
it's good to take a break. That's why I like to go back and forth between my genre to keep it all interesting. All right, that was very chatty. And I think we have to do a little bingo update here because...
Tis the season.
It is so close. It will start on Friday, May 24th, which when this episode goes live, will be about a week and a half away. So we should also have our updated summer 2024 bingo card.
You'll see it pop up in our Instagram stories, and then it will be in the story highlights, and we'll pin it there for the whole summer. You can see last year's...
One of them is still up there for sure. So you can pull it off of there, or you can send us an email at craftcookreadrepeat@gmail.com, and we will send you a PDF, or you can message me on Ravelry, Magdon on Ravelry, MAGDON, and we will, for either of those, we will need an actual email address for you to email it, the PDF, and then you can print it or, you know, play around with the colors and however you want to mark off your bingo. And it'll be the same as before. Lots of fun prompts, very easy to interpret however works best for you. You get a bingo, you post your bingo, and enter to win fabulous prizes, which we will determine at a later date. There will be crafting, there will be cooking, there will be reading, there will be a free space. We'll go over it all again next time. But
you can earn a bingo by reading alone, by cooking alone, or by crafting alone. Like, you don't have to be a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker in order to achieve this.
But you can be. And if you want to get a blackout, which is all of the squares covered, you will get to enter an extra prize entry. But then you will have to do all the things.
All the things.
All the things. But that is fun stuff. You do not have to post pictures anywhere of what you're doing, although we honestly, that is our favorite part. So we hope you will. And the hashtag on Instagram will be CCRR Summer Bingo 2024. And there'll be a thread on Ravelry that we will set up. And it'll just be lots of fun and good times and hopefully low stress. Just
Hopefully it will help give a little bit of shape to your summer if that is something that you are craving.
And let us know if you have any questions once you see the bingo card, and we will do our best to answer them. And until next time, make sure to do something you love every day.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Show notes can be found at craftcookreadrepeat.podbean.com. You can find us on Instagram as craftcookreadrepeat or CourtneySF, that's CourtneySF. On Ravelry, I'm Magdon, MAGDON. And if you have any questions or comments, email us at craftcookreadrepeat@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.